do. Hang in there and
thank
carry
you.
On, brother.
Okay, you all as right. well. Take care. And you've been listening to More Talk Radio here in your community radio station. I'm Cecil Prescott. Thank you for calling. Stay tuned for more excellent programming. If you're listening live, the next program you'll hear is Omo Variety Hour. In the meantime, take care of yourself and those you love. I'm Cecil Prescott, and we will hear you, speak to you, be in your presence the next time.
Is a legal ID. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and I am Dr. Demento, just barely legal.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have the words green or renewable in them. But then when you dig into them more deeply, it turns out that not only are they a waste of precious time, but they actually are climate solutions that are worse for the climate. It's like chasing chimeras, a beast from Greek mythology, which sounds fabulous, but ends up to be a fanciful illusion.
Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a new documentary by veteran producer Barbara Bernstein, premieres on Locus Focus Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m. Tune in to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM Portland, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or 91.9 FM Hood River, or anywhere in the world streaming online at kboo.fm. That's Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions on Locus Focus, Monday, January 27th at 10 a.m.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, wish there's a mole in the ground.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, and on today's episode, we hear about some of the military technology invading our lives, and about some of the musicians and activists resisting and refusing and working for a better world. Thank you to all the KBOO members who make this station possible, and please remember that you can support the station by texting KBOO to 44321 or by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app. On today's Old Mole, Lori Mercier talks with Roberto J. Gonzalez, a professor of anthropology at San Jose State University, about data-driven warfare and how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex. Then, we hear from Desiree Hellegers about the racism of the nuclear industry and about creative resistance to it. Finally, we hear from an interview that Desiree did with organizer Barbara Ford about her history of activism, climate justice, and the importance of emotionally grounded and creative actions. You'll be able to find the audio of this episode and its segments on our website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find links to subscribe to the show and to support this listener-sponsored community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab in the upper right corner of the webpage at kboo.fm. We turn now to Lori Mercier and Roberto Gonzalez.
Good morning. This is Lori Mercier, and I'm speaking to Roberto Gonzalez, a professor of anthropology at San Jose State University, whose recent work has focused on militarization and culture in the United States. He's the author of many articles and books, including Anthropologists in the Public Sphere, Speaking Out on War, Peace, and American Power, American Counterinsurgency, Human Science and the Human Terrain, Militarizing Culture, Essays on the Warfare State, and most recently, War Virtually, The Quest to Automate Conflict, Militarize Data, and Predict the Future. He's working on a new book about algorithmic policing in the United States. Today, we're talking about how Silicon Valley is transforming the military-industrial complex. Welcome to KBOO, Roberto Gonzalez.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've written about how big tech is increasingly fused with the military-industrial complex. Tell us how and why this happened.
Well, what's happening now is part of a much longer process that began in the 1950s with the emergence of the Silicon Valley region as a major site for R&D that was largely financed by the U.S. military and intelligence agencies during the Cold War. Silicon Valley, I think, and the United States as a whole, has this image of the region as a place that was built up by these savvy, independent, maverick entrepreneur engineers who built fantastic new technologies like semiconductors and the internet with their own genius, largely self-funded. That's not the case at all. In fact, the entire region developed largely through Cold War funding. For decades, the largest employer in the area was not Atari or Apple or Ampex. It was Lockheed Martin. And Lockheed Martin continues to be a very large economic power in the region. So what's happened over the past 20 years or so is that you have a new generation of companies that collectively we call big tech that include household names like Microsoft, Google, Oracle, Amazon, some of which are not even based in the San Francisco Bay Area or Silicon Valley, but collectively are still described as Silicon Valley. And what's happened with these big tech firms over the past 10 years in particular is that they've become more and more invested in seeking out large multi-year, multi-billion dollar Pentagon contracts. So that's really what I've been most interested in documenting is the recent phase in this long-term process of the militarization of the tech industry that really stretches back to its origins.
Now, you trace this more recent marriage, I suppose, back to 2011 when President Obama authorized the drone strike that assassinated Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S.-born Muslim cleric. And although Obama and subsequent administrations and the Department of Defense have touted the drone's precision, as you document, the so-called advanced technology presents many problems. What are some of the problems associated with drone warfare?
Right. Well, I think to understand some of the problems, one needs to put this in again, in historical perspective. The period between 2011 and 2015 or 2016 was critical for the emphasis on a new form of high tech, or what at the time was called data-driven warfare. The historical context is this, that it emerged at a time when it was becoming increasingly clear that the United States military's commitment to the Petraeus era counterinsurgency model, boots on the ground, social scientists on the ground, a kind of throwback almost to Vietnam era counterinsurgency tactics, that strategy was failing by 2010, 2011. And so the Obama administration came in and began to explore new, really tech-focused alternatives to classic counterinsurgency. And what developed out of that was what some have called computational counterinsurgency. So basically using all kinds of big data collected from drones, surveillance drones, collected from other kinds of sensors, from satellites, from internet usage patterns, from cell phone patterns, and really just crunch those numbers to come up with lists of potential terrorists or potential insurgents. And what emerged out of that were these kinds of essentially hit lists. And because these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were becoming increasingly unpopular with Americans and US troop casualty counts were increasing, drone warfare, or one way of thinking of this is war by remote control, became more and more popular during the 2010s. The advantages, of course, are potentially the fewer deaths of U.S. servicemen and women. But the downside, as we know from lots of investigative reports that have been done since that time, is that it also resulted in large numbers of civilian casualties in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other theaters in the war on terror. So that is the big downside. Apart from the sheer violence of civilian casualties, large numbers of civilian casualties, numbering in the tens of thousands if we add up Iraq and Afghanistan together, then there's also a psychological component. And we know quite a lot now about the negative psychological impact of drone warfare on people perhaps who were never physically hurt by this war by remote control, but for years carried this burden of fear and terror of being constantly subjected to surveillance and potential violence inflicted by drones. Interestingly, and this is, I think, less well known to the public, drone warfare has also, at least in its remote controlled form, led to significant patterns of mental health problems among U.S. drone crews. Now, for years, critics of drone warfare said, well, you know, these troops are just, they're like video gamers, right? I mean, they're basically killing with impunity and doing so without any compunction or sense of guilt. In reality, it turns out, now that there's been quite a bit of research on this, drone warfare has had a serious psychological impact on drone crews themselves. I'm talking about, again, U.S. servicemen and women from the Air Force who are essentially pulling the trigger from thousands of miles away without fully knowing whether or not their actions will result in civilian casualties or not. So what's emerged out of this is patterns of post-traumatic stress disorder, not too much unlike what one might expect from troops on the ground physically in a battle space, in an actual battle space, as opposed to a virtual one.
And that's despite the military's training of these drone technicians to thinking that these are merely video games. I mean, isn't much the training about creating this kind of video game atmosphere?
Yes, that's essentially a part of the training, as I understand it, is that it's the kind of classic training that I think all modern military personnel go through, not just in the U.S., but in other countries, which is the dehumanization and the objectification of the target. What's interesting in the case of remote control drone warfare, which continues to be the primary use of drones, as opposed to, say, autonomous or fully autonomous drones that pick their own targets. But when it comes to remote control, you've got a paradox, essentially. So you've got, on the one hand, an increase in the distance between the target and the killer. On the other hand, you've got a compression of space to the extent that the drone crews are sometimes monitoring a target for days or weeks at a time with a fine enough video resolution that they can see that this person living the details of their everyday life as they go from one area to another, as they go on outings perhaps with their families or friends, as they engage in community activities, so that they begin to see that the target themselves as an actual person despite the far geographic distance. And that is very likely the cause of the PTSD, is the psychological proximity that this kind of drone warfare brings with it.
I don't know if you've seen the powerful recent film From Ground Zero, which includes 22 short films by different filmmakers about life in Gaza during warfare. But in each of the 22 films, or short films, there's the constant buzzing sound of drones overhead. So it was very striking to me that no one in Gaza can escape the terrifying sights and sounds of 24/7 drone surveillance. But despite this targeted surveillance and so-called advanced technology, for the last 15 months, Israel has indiscriminately dropped U.S.-made bombs on families in tents, hospitals, ambulances, everywhere and everyone. So what is the argument about Israel's so-called superior technology if the results, genocide, are the same as 20th century warfare?
That is the question. I think that is the reason that I'm so critical of where things are headed. I mean, despite the continuing rhetoric about the advanced technology leading to greater and greater surgical precision, to use one of the phrases that, for example, the Defense Department had long used, or the kinds of claims that the Israeli Defense Ministry has made about the accuracy and precision of its strikes. On the ground, the reality is, as you say, in Gaza, many, many civilian casualties, primarily women and children, the razing of entire communities, the destruction of key infrastructural, hospitals, electricity grids, that kind of thing. I think what makes the war in Gaza quite strikingly different from the U.S. war on terror is the fact that Israel, this has now been widely reported, has been using a number of artificial intelligence-enabled technologies. And what this has led to, and I think this is what we should all be concerned about, is the acceleration of warfare, so that the vast scale of both physical as well as infrastructural destruction in a place like Gaza is partially the result of the acceleration of the attacks. So what AI does is to speed things up. It means that decisions are made automatically, autonomously in some cases, with such rapidity that there is not enough time for a human actor to intervene if for example, there's some kind of an error in the data coming in. And so this is something I think that we should all be paying attention to. And it's happening if we look beyond the war in Gaza, if we look beyond the war in Ukraine, if we think about the global geopolitical context of what some people call an AI arms race between the United States and China. Well, in many ways, we're back to a kind of Cold War nuclear arms race kind of mentality. And again, I think this is something that we should all be paying attention to, be concerned about, be in contact with our elected officials about our concerns, because there is, a level of fear and also, frankly, hype around this idea of an AI arms race and the need for the United States to remain the world's, sole superpower, et cetera, that's driving this, that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, I now understand why you have been so critical about big tech's entry into, the longstanding arena of the Pentagon's horribly bloated and corrupt budget, which includes a revolving door between Congress and Department of Defense officials and boards of military contractors. So the big tech entry has really raised, it sounds like has really raised the level of danger of the future of warfare. And why are these contracts so secret? And how have they evaded scrutiny?
Well, a lot of these contracts are classified contracts. And, I think the argument is because the technologies are so new, or the uses are so sort of sensitive in terms of national security, that the details in terms of the amounts of the contract should not be publicized, nor the details about what the contracts are for. The CIA, of course, has a long history of working in a classified fashion. The CIA, unlike the military, reports to the executive branch directly. So there's all kinds of political reasons in terms of why those budgets continue to be classified. But beyond that, I mean, even for those contracts that are not classified, if one is doing research on the contracts themselves, it's an incredibly complex and confusing process Because let's say you have a $10 billion contract that's spread out over a five-year period that's divided up between two major contractors. Each of those major contractors may well have 5 or 10 or 15 subcontractors that it then parcels the work out to. So it very quickly becomes a complicated picture to get precise dollar amounts or to get a precise picture of what exactly a particular company is working on within a larger framework. The person that I know in the institution, the organization that I think is doing the best work in this area, and I encourage all of your listeners to check it out, there's a nonprofit research group called Tech Inquiry, and their website is techinquiry.org. And they've got a fantastic resource, which is a searchable database of military contracts that is greatly useful to researchers, reporters, and the citizens as a whole, anybody interested in this topic, so that you can search, for example, a particular company like Anduril Industries or Palantir or Google and find out what contracts they've gotten, at least technically how they're listed in the congressional budget reports. And this is all essentially, it's aggregating openly accessible information and putting it in one place. The person that got this off the ground, he's a very interesting person by the name of Jack Polson. He's a doctor of mathematics. He's a former senior scientist at Google, and then decided to quit his job, I believe in 2017 or 2018, as the first widely publicized Google military contracts came to light. And he caught my attention because of an op-ed he wrote in the New York Times titled, "I used to work for Google, but I don't anymore. I'm a conscientious objector," or something along those lines. And what he did with his career in his post-Google career is just fascinating in terms of doing the general public and the taxpayers a great service by putting his mathematical skills to work to do a kind of public interest database on military industrial contracts in the tech sector.
Thanks for that recommendation, and we will link to it on the KBOO website. This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. I'm speaking with Professor Roberto Gonzalez, professor at San Jose State University, about how big tech and Silicon Valley are transforming the military-industrial complex. Well, Professor Gonzalez, we've seen Elon Musk shadowing Trump for months, and now the other tech billionaires have joined the Trump bandwagon. What's the significance of their influence? I mean, already with major DoD contracts.
Well, it's hard to know for sure. You know, we're talking about, apart from people with very large companies that they manage, that they direct, also with very large egos. And given the fact that someone like Elon Musk and President Trump, although they may be getting along fine now, it's hard to say what their relationship might look like 6 months from now. What I will say is this, that apart from Elon Musk, there are many, many other tech executives that have very quickly aligned themselves with the Trump administration. During the campaign, there were some interest by the press on people like Peter Thiel, who co-founded Palantir Industries, and Palmer Luckey, who is the CEO of Anduril Industries, which is another tech company very much invested in AI technologies and becoming increasingly important in the business of Pentagon contracts. And then also you've got a number of people from the venture capital world. And it's important not to leave the VC investors out of this discussion either. Venture capital, of course, you know, these are financiers, big time investors who are looking for oftentimes startup companies, small startups, so that they can fund these. And then if the small startups either get acquired or go public, become publicly traded corporations, then that VC investment pays off big time. And Trump, interestingly, drew quite a bit of funding from some of the big venture capital firms, most notably Andreessen Horowitz is one of the biggest two VC firms. So the connection here is that the venture capital world has increasingly pumped money into small defense tech startups, so that apart from the big tech companies, you know, the SpaceX, Elon Musk's firm, Google, Microsoft, and these companies, you've got literally dozens and dozens of small startups funded by these largely Silicon Valley-based venture capital funds. So they're jumping on board very quickly. I think they're going to have a huge influence in shaping U.S. military policy. You know, one could say that it was that this has been long overdue, that the legacy, the old defense firms were just too stuck in the past, stuck in their ways, and that this is what the Pentagon needs. But I have many concerns about where this is headed, not just because of artificial intelligence and AI-enabled weapon and surveillance systems, but also because of the lack of transparency that I think will come along with this inevitably. And the forms of accelerated warfare that we're likely to see going forward.
Yeah, if Gaza and Ukraine are indicators of just the killing fields that are created by this kind of warfare. And even though the face of the military-industrial complex is changing, as you indicate, this is still a huge drain on the public treasury, the U.S. military budget, which all of these capitalists lining up to feed at the trough will at least continue, if not accelerate. And so what, Professor Gonzalez, as an anthropologist, do you have to offer in terms of thinking about how we replace the war-based economy and culture with one that is peace-based?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question. It's a great question, and this is partially why I got into this area, which is fairly uncommon, I think, for a cultural anthropologist to dive into the world of the military-industrial complex. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, my position is very critical, and my critical perspective and my criticism is largely informed by my experience in having the opportunity to live in societies that are very different from ours and to learn from them. And so, you know, if we take one example, we can travel to most Western European countries and find that if you've traveled at all through a place like the Netherlands, for example, you find that the infrastructure is just, for example, the train system to get from one area to another, very efficient, very inexpensive. There's all kinds of elements of infrastructure, elements of public education. There are other ways that tax dollars can be spent other than this massive military outlay, which is now in approximating $1 trillion or approaching $1 trillion a year in the United States. But think of how all of that could be used to invest in other parts of our society. Again, education, the healthcare system, climate change mitigation, you name it. All of these alternatives are being squandered because of the huge amounts of taxpayer money that have gone to the military-industrial complex. In the past, you know, the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and the BA Systems and the Raytheons. In the future, very likely, the Microsofts and the Amazons and the Googles. So this, is, of course, is a huge concern. And creating a peace-based economy, I think, is going to take all of us raising those questions, making those criticisms, thinking about those alternatives, creating our own alternatives locally as well, if our federal government is not going to provide the support that we need. I think also that the incentive structures need to change. I think we as a society need to think about how to make a peace-based economy. What are these incentives for doing that? What are the incentives that will get our politicians diverting more of those funds away from defense and towards the kinds of real human needs that our society has?
Well, thank you so much. And I know locally that this week, the Oregon Investment Council is meeting and lots of folks are planning to call attention to the Oregon Investment Council's investments in war-producing industries and Israel bonds and so on to try to redirect those investments to more productive uses. And often on this show, I recommend the Cost of War Project, which I know, Roberto, you have published, or you're a fellow of the Brown University Cost of War Project, and also the National Priorities Project, where people can look up how tax dollars coming from Oregon could be redirected into public housing, education, food assistance, all kinds of more positive uses, social uses. So thanks so much for joining us today, Roberto Gonzalez. We'll link to some of your work on the Old Mole Variety Hour page on the KBOO website. Thanks again.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Lori. I was happy to talk with you.
Thanks a lot.
That was some of Freedom Day from We Insist, Max Roach's Freedom Now Suite. And before that, we heard Lori Mercier talking with anthropologist Roberto Gonzalez about big tech and the military. I'm Fran Michel, and you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I first heard Freedom Day when I watched the documentary Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. Like the film From Ground Zero that Lori mentioned, it was shortlisted for the 97th Academy Awards. Unlike From Ground Zero, it's both on the nominee list and available streaming on Canopy through the Multnomah County Library, so you can check it out if you have a library card and an internet connection. Lori also mentioned the Oregon Investment Council, which oversees the investment and allocation of all State of Oregon trust funds, including the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund, the Common School Fund, and the State Accident Insurance Fund. Lori's conversation with Professor Gonzalez was recorded before the January OIC meeting, which happened last week, but we'll post a link to their site on the page for this episode to help you check out their next meeting in March, and you can send them public comment anytime. Next up, we hear from Desiree Heligers about nuclear colonialism and anti-nuclear organizing.
I don't know what's on your list of New Year's resolutions, but not getting my ass blown off in a nuclear war or meltdown is pretty high on my list of personal priorities for the coming year. I mean, it's true, there are plenty of other things I could be worrying about right now. In fact, I mean, if there was anything like truth in advertising in the U.S., we would have long ago swapped out George Washington's face and E Pluribus Unum on the dollar bill for Alfred E. Newman and, what, me worry? Seeing so many Christian Zionists chomping at the bit for the end times isn't exactly reassuring. And it doesn't help that neither newly elected President Scrooge McDuck nor his co-pilot Elmo Musk has demonstrated the generosity or impulse control of your average cephalopod or cuttlefish. Not that I imagine Joe Genocide Biden as any kind of paragon of restraint, but I can hardly have been alone in banking on Sleepy Joe forgetting the codes after a nice glass of warm milk. But the worm having turned and headed back to the White House, the coming year seems like a critical window to form common cause around putting the brakes on a nuclear industry that's as eager as ever to profit from playing Russian roulette with the planet. The good news is that anti-nuke organizing has a decades-long tradition of effective messaging and mobilizing through art, music, and storytelling. Whether they grew up against the backdrop of civil defense drills, ducking and covering under their desks in the 1950s and 60s, or amid a succession of nuclear accidents in the 1970s and 80s, anti-nuke organizers have produced a rich art of resistance that's helped galvanize and sustain the movement. The bad news is that the nuclear industry is now hell-bent on selling us on small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs, and on repackaging itself as a white knight in shimmering armor, an upright corporate swain bent on rescuing us from the ravages of climate collapse. As that venerable old Jewish peace activist and physicist Albert Einstein famously observed, God doesn't play dice with the universe. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the nuclear industry, which got a big boost in 2022 with the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA. The White House website lauded Biden's visionary leadership in signing the act into law. Quote, with the stroke of his pen, the president redefined American leadership in confronting the existential threat of the climate crisis, unquote. You'll have to look elsewhere to the Department of Energy's website for mention of the IRA's greenwashing giveaway to the nuclear industry. Quote, Inflation Reduction Act keeps momentum building for nuclear power, unquote, reads the nearly gleeful banner headline. In an even bigger bonanza for nuclear profiteers, in 2024, Biden signed off on a 40-year extension of the Price-Anderson Act, which Public Citizen describes as a billion-dollar bailout for nuclear power mishaps. Environment America explains that the act caps the industry's liability for a, quote, catastrophic accident at any one of the U.S.'s 54 nuclear plants at $16.1 billion in damages, unquote, leaving taxpayers to pick up the tab for the rest. For perspective, according to Reuters, the total cost of the Fukushima disaster was estimated in 2016 at $188 billion. And even at that, damages paid to individuals affected by radiation contamination would almost surely be minimal at best. The industry's recklessness is on full display in an April 2024 report by the Government Accounting Office, highlighted in an October Counterpunch commentary by Linda Pence-Gunter, founder and international specialist with Beyond Nuclear. The report and Gunter's commentary make clear that we shouldn't waste energy pinning our regulatory hopes on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, or NRC. The NRC, as the report makes clear, fails to, quote, fully consider potential increases in risk from climate change, using historical data to identify and assess nuclear risks rather than data from future climate projections, unquote. That's right, the NRC's permitting process does not consistently factor in climate projections like rising sea levels, temperatures, extreme weather events, etc. As Pence-Gunter so aptly puts it, the NRC, which is, quote, intent on colluding with the nuclear industry to sell us nuclear power as some kind of answer to the climate crisis, appears entirely uninterested in how the ravages of the climate crisis might jeopardize the safety of nuclear power plants, unquote. And that, kids, ought to go a long way toward explaining how Matt Groening's Homer Simpson came to personify the reckless lack of oversight, accountability, and even common sense at the very heart of the nuclear industry. Given the many well-documented allusions in The Simpsons to Portland, Oregon, where Groening grew up, it's safe to assume that the inspiration for Homer's workplace was none other than the aptly named Trojan Nuclear Power Plant, just 42 miles from Portland. The plant, which went live in 1975, became a flashpoint for anti-nuke organizing. Jan Hawkins' 2023 documentary, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, documents the organizing ferment that led to the plant being shuttered in 1993 and demolished in 2005. It's no doubt a tribute to the satirical power of Groening's brainchild that the DOE devotes a website to elucidating, quote, seven things the Simpsons got wrong about nuclear, unquote, while acknowledging that, quote, America's longest-running animated series on Fox has been making nuclear workers cringe on their couches for almost three decades now, unquote. But let's be clear that the real villains in The Simpsons are not everyday workers who work hard and play hard and would like nothing more than to get down. That's a clip from a truly classic episode of The Simpsons that ends with a note dedicated to the steelworkers of America. Keep reaching for the rainbow. The clue to the villain is in the CEO's name, Mr. Burns. The racist roots of the U.S. nuclear industry go back to the 1880s and the Belgian King Leopold's brutal assault on the Congo. From the very start of King Leopold's war, the U.S. was only too willing to collaborate in exploiting workers to death in its quest to liberate the Congo of its resources. And by the 1940s, the U.S. had grown particularly fond of Congolese uranium, which was used to produce the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. If you have a strong stomach and you want a small taste of the scale of destruction and the sheer horrors that the U.S. helped Belgium unleash on the Congo in its quest to extract resources and labor, you might check out the 2021 miniseries Exterminate All the Brutes, written, directed, and narrated by Raoul Peck. Cutting off the hands of child workers was a standard daily practice in the Belgian War on the Congo. In August 1960, Patrice Lumumba, the first democratically elected president of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, who was also a leader of the Congolese independence movement, had barely been in office a month when President Dwight D. Eisenhower handed down the order to the CIA director and veteran coup master, Alan Dulles, to have Lumumba eliminated. And it's perhaps one of the great ironies of history that the same day, January 17, 1961, that the outgoing president delivered his famous farewell address on the dangers of the military-industrial complex, Patrice Lumumba was killed in a hail of bullets that had Eisenhower's bloody fingerprints all over it. As George Nzelgola Ntaleja wrote in The Guardian on the 50th anniversary of his assassination, it was Lumumba's, quote, determination to have full control over Congo's resources in order to utilize them to improve the living conditions of our people, unquote. But as Angola and Ntaleja also observed, the U.S. was not about to relinquish its, quote, strategic stake on the enormous natural wealth of the Congo, unquote, and certainly not its uranium. Today, the bloody conflicts the U.S. helped King Leopold and Belgium unleash on the Congo continue, with mass rape and slavery, including of children, used as weapons in the scramble for coltan and other conflict minerals for our precious cell phones and laptops. Especially if you're a teacher, you might check out the Zen Education Project's curriculum on Congo, coltan, and cell phones, a people's history, along with their broader work on nuclear energy, weapons, and war. In the wake of Hurricane Helene, which killed an estimated 100 people in North Carolina and caused some $53 billion in damages to North Carolina alone, I checked in with a dear friend who's lived there for decades, and I was relieved to hear her house and town had gone relatively unscathed. And when I offered some helpful observations about the catastrophic impacts yet to come from climate change, my friend was suddenly uncharacteristically cheerful. Nuclear energy, she advised me, would save us from our planetary pickle. My surprise was greater for the fact that my friend and I came of age together in the 1970s and 80s, driving the serpentine back roads of Maryland, smoking weed, and listening to the legendary 1979 No Nukes album, the Muse Concerts for a Non-Nuclear Future. Looking back, it seems telling that as two white women, we might have worried about getting busted for the weed, but the possibility of death by a cop never even occurred to us. The Muse Collective, Musicians for Safe Energy, formed close on the heels of the March 1979 partial meltdown at Three Mile Island Reactor in Pennsylvania. If you want a quick primer on the Three Mile Island meltdown and the organizing that helped shut the plant down, you might check out Heidi Huttner's 2022 documentary, Radioactive, The Women of Three Mile Island. Recorded live over the course of five concerts in Madison Square Garden, the Muse concerts featured a host of musical luminaries too many to name. Jackson Brown, Bonnie Raitt, Gil Scott-Heron, Bruce Springsteen, Chaka Khan, Sweet Honey and the Rock, Tom Petty, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and on and on. And if the album helped fast-track Three Mile Island into the lexicon of American disasters, the song We Almost Lost Detroit by Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson highlighted a lesser-known 1966 partial meltdown at the Enrico Fermi nuclear power plant outside Detroit.
Just 30 miles from Detroit stands a giant power station. It ticks each night as the city sleeps, seconds from annihilation. But no one stopped to think about the people or how they would survive. And we almost lost Detroit this time. How would we ever get over losing our mind? The sheriff of Monroe County had a sure enough disasters on his mind. And what would Karen Silkwood say to you if she was still alive? That when it comes to people's safety, money wins out every time.
The title of the song was inspired by a 1975 book by John G. Fuller about the meltdown. In their song, Scott-Heron and Jackson capture the fundamental irrationality and craven financial interests of an industry that poses an existential threat, not just to nuclear workers in Monroe County, but to Detroit and neighboring Wayne County, and presumably well beyond. References to the 1974 death of labor organizer, nuclear whistleblower Karen Silkwood highlight the corruption of the industry and its treatment of workers as disposable commodities. You can find a quick primer on Silkwood's organizing and its long aftermath in a November 2024 edition of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, marking the 50th anniversary of Silkwood's death. After her death at the age of 28, Silkwood became the focus of an eponymously titled 1984 film starring Meryl Streep, Kurt Russell, and Cher. But before you watch the film, you might check out the PBS Frontline documentary on Silkwood. A white chemical technician from Texas, Silkwood produced nuclear pellets at the Kerr McGee Cimarron plant in Oklahoma. But she was also a labor organizer with the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, OCAW, as well as a health and safety inspector at the plant and the first woman to serve on OCAW's bargaining committee. When Silkwood detected a laundry list of safety violations, she testified before the Atomic Energy Commission about safety concerns at the plant. Shortly before her death, Silkwood and her apartment were both contaminated with plutonium. But plutonium was not what killed Silkwood. The 28-year-old union organizer was killed in a fatal car accident on her way to hand off critical documents about the goings-on at Kerr McGee to a New York Times reporter. There were indications she'd been run off the road, and by the time Silkwood's body was recovered from the car, the documents were nowhere to be found. While no criminal charges were filed in the case, Kerr McGee ultimately settled a $1.3 million civil suit brought by Silkwood's family. In 2014, Kerr McGee agreed to pay a $5.15 billion settlement, including for, quote, environmental cleanup at contaminated sites around the country, unquote, with Corporate Crime Reporter describing the settlement as, quote, the largest environmental enforcement recovery ever by the Department of Justice, unquote. But the settlement likely barely scratched the surface of damages that Deputy Attorney General James Cole laid out, including to the Navajo Nation. Quote, for 85 years, Kerr McGee operated numerous hazardous businesses, and those businesses caused significant damage to the environment and to communities exposed to contamination, Cole said. In Scott Herron and Jackson's pithy critique, the same nuclear industry that killed Karen Silkwood played dice with the city of Detroit. Scott Herron and Jackson's song is a dirge and a warning, treating the nuclear industry as anything but a menace, a threat to workers and public safety, is itself a form of madness. This is Desiree Hilligers for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
When it comes to people's safety, money wins out every time.
You just heard Gil Scott-Heron performing We Almost Lost Detroit from the album Bridges by Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson, and Desiree Hilligers reading from their essay about American nuclear disaster and resistance, which you can find in full on counterpunch.org. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You can find more from Desiree Hilligers on Open Signal and YouTube. The second episode of their series, How I Learned to Breathe Through the Apocalypse, is available now, and we'll post a link on our episode page. A surreal, hallucinatory black comedy set entirely inside the playwright performer's head, the series is based on journals Hilligers kept during a 30-day Shambhala Buddhist meditation retreat in December 2005. The play explores Catholic and Buddhist white saviorism, spiritual consumerism, U.S. military violence, and fascism, and makes a compelling case for the power of meditation and of art, and specifically comedy, as indispensable tools of anti-fascist resistance and planetary survival. In the two-part second episode, How I Accidentally Killed My Father, Hilligers grapples with the intergenerational effects of war and the role they may have played as a surly teenager in the sudden death of their father, who was a child refugee from the Nazis. Finally today on The Old Mole, we'll hear more about the importance of creativity in resistance in these words from organizer Barbara Ford from an interview done by Desiree Hilligers.
As a social worker by trade, I had been very interested in how people are functioning, capable of functioning in the world, how trauma works. But the personal work, I left the business a lot, not so much because of my clients, because I love my clients, but because the healthcare system was pretty messed up also. And I felt like I was being asked to do unethical work. But I still had a skill set that I brought of working with groups, of facilitating meetings, etc. I'd also say that my work in helping to form this intentional community, Columbia Eco Village here in Portland, sort of became a part of that too, because I was choosing to live more sustainably, choosing to be more thoughtful about, you know, how to live with other people, what that might mean for the world in the future, and getting a group of 60 people together to think about how to do that constructively was a great challenge and a good learning opportunity for me. So. Yeah, probably the first involvement I had in organizing in general was just in the women's rights and LGBT and anti-nuclear movement. I wouldn't say I was a mover and shaker. I was a single mom and I was in school and I couldn't take the same kind of risks that other people could, but I definitely was showing up at the rallies and feeding people and different things like that. And that was back when the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant was a huge issue here in Portland and in Oregon. But I would say that my main kind of organizing really started in 2001. After 9/11, I felt called to get back involved with a faith community that was activist oriented. And we were involved with a program called the Green Sanctuary Program that was started by this small nonprofit, UU Ministry for Earth. And our job was to sort of move the denomination forward and devoting their energies and resources to the issue of climate change particularly. And during that whole time, both within the UU faith, as it is also nationally, climate justice, the idea of climate justice was coming more to the fore, and the leadership of people of color who were on the front lines was coming forward also. And people were listening more deeply to the stories of not just climate change and the whales and all that, but also of asthma and the poisoning, the toxins that were happening from various refineries, such as in Richmond, California, refineries down in Louisiana area, especially after Katrina happened. And it's been a journey for all of us, specifically white environmentalists, to learn to honor and follow that leadership. I'd gone to Washington, D.C. in 2011 for the very first civil disobedience action that 350 had organized, which was the mass arrests for 17 days. I was arrested on day 9 with the faith group. And I remember I took the train across the country, and it was this huge, like, fossil fuel education going through the areas where the fracked gases were happening and then through the areas where we were seeing the coal trains coming through. And I was thinking, why do I have to go across the country to do this work? As it turned out, we got stuck in Chicago on the train because a hurricane had come through. So all the trains were stopped and we ended up having to drive to D.C. But on the way back, it was like coal trains all the way across and then up again through that area where they were just getting the fracking going, and you could see the flares from the train, and just going through the areas of Montana particularly, I saw the Bakken. And I actually sat and had dinner once with somebody who was working in the fields, who was a technician working in the fields. It was quite a shock to see the flares, the burning of this gas, especially at night. You know, the train is going through and you just see these flares of light. Another experience I had on the train going out and back was having dinner with people who were from Pennsylvania and New York, who were having their lands seized or having these huge offers being made, where they were just talking about how essentially they felt invaded by an army of fossil fuel employees who were trying to essentially take over their lands and their water and everything. So I had firsthand conversations with people on that train. And I remember thinking, well, I don't think there's fracking in Oregon. I don't think, you know, I'm wondering how I can do local work. How can I do local work? And then I kind of came to understand over time, they have to get it to the coast. There's a whole infrastructure issue that we have. Even though fracking isn't actually happening in the state of Oregon, we are vital to the industry to get that gas and oil and coal out. And that's when I sort of started learning more and understanding that there is a local movement that I can join and be a part of. I'm actually not the greatest organizer in the world, but I do have a particular heart set and skill set that was about the role of arts in the movement, and also the capacity to look at how we're going to take care of ourselves and each other in the movement as well. And so this came out of a fairly long-term involvement I'd had training with and working with the deep ecologist and systems theorist Joanna Macy. I had started training with her in 2005. My heart needed that work very, very deeply. And I met people from all over the world who were doing very powerful work and supported by the model that she gave us around how to be present to the world, how to support each other, and how to help others in that realm. So that's sort of when I approached 350PDX. I said, this is what I have to offer. I can offer this level of support to the activist community. And I also really think that art is a very important part of this movement. And so they had done some art, but they didn't have anybody organizing it. So we started an arts team. And then later on, just recently, actually, we've started a new program called the Climate Odyssey Program. That is a gathering of ideas related to kind of resilient strategies, community building, art, and anti-racism, anti-oppression work, as we're moving forward into really becoming clear actors and allies in the environmental justice movement. So how do we open up a movement to make it accessible for people and help them find ways to do it without losing heart, totally losing heart? Because the news is bad every day. The news is bad. And right now, in this moment, the news is really bad. Like, how do you be with that and feel still empowered to work within your community and not just shut down? So that is the piece of work that I feel is kind of like my call to do. So I do workshops in all different kinds of communities. I've been doing a lot more within the climate justice community particularly. And it really just sort of offers a place for people to share their true feelings, because I think in the activist community, despair sort of becomes like a dirty word. If you talk about it, like you're being accused of being too negative or, you know, undermining the movement or whatever. And it's so necessary for people to speak their despair, because the things we shut down are the things that are going to harm us in the end. And anger. Anger is a really viable emotion to have at this moment in time. Our anger is tied to our passion for justice. Grief is a huge part of it as well. So there's just a way to affirm the feelings, and by, you know, in systems theory terms, as Joanna teaches, it's a release of energy when we allow ourselves to have and experience those feelings, to feel it in community, to know that we're not crazy, we're not the only ones who feel this way, and understand that it's a part of our journey together. I called the Climate Odyssey program the Climate Odyssey because the story no longer, at this moment in time, has to do with winning or losing. It has to do with, we're on this journey together, we're trying to get home, we don't know if we'll ever make it, we don't know what home will look like if we get there, but in the meantime, we're, you know, encountering these various limitations or the threshold guardians, like the sirens and the cyclops and the Koch brothers and whatever. But we're still on this journey, and who will we be with each other on this journey? And how will we learn to not turn on each other when the going gets hard? So I see art as vital to the movement for a variety of reasons. One is that it's an opportunity for people to offer their gifts in ways that are not traditionally organizing skills. People coming together for art builds, for example, as a way of organizing people into the movement, for one, and to do something joyful and beautiful and create these things that they know they're going to see in the press. We made these beautiful sunflower umbrellas, and I had a very strong commitment, like I had this vision that these were going to be like the iconic Portland sunflower umbrellas. And they sort of have turned out to be that way in just a couple of years, where they're showing up at all these events, including at Arrestable events. They're not like illustrations, they're kind of loosely done. And then we make banners and signs, and we've made puppets. And it adds something to the movement. It adds something to the marches that we have, the visuals. All of a sudden, the press comes to see what it's going to look like. It's not just a bunch of people with their fists in the air. It's people with these beautiful signs and corn cobs and umbrellas and, you know, puppets and things. And it brings a focus of joy to the movement.
Thank you.
That was more from Freedom Day, from We Insist, Max Roach's Freedom Now suite. And before that, Barbara Ford, interviewed by Desiree Hilligers. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I've been your host today, Fran Michelle. Many thanks to Desiree Hilligers, Barbara Ford, Lori Mercier, Roberto Gonzalez, and to all of KBOO's members, volunteers, and staff. You can join KBOO by texting KBOO to 44321 or by clicking on the red Donate tab on the KBOO app or on the website at kboo.fm. You can also find audio and more information on our show page there at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. We'll go out with more of Abby Lincoln and Max Roach performing Freedom Day.
Whisper, say we're free. Rumors flying, must be lying. Can it really be? Can't conceive it, don't believe it, but that's what they say. Slave no longer, this is Freedom Day. Freedom Day, Freedom Day. Throw those shackling chains away. Everybody that we see says it's really true. We're free. Freedom Day, Freedom Day. Free to vote and earn our pay. Dim the path and hide the way. But we've made it Freedom Day.
KBOO Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It feels very...